Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 30th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll start with a five-day forecast, and today is going to be warm with a predicted high of 78, but there are chances for severe thunderstorms this afternoon. And tonight, the low will be 45. Wednesday will not be quite as warm with a high of 67 and a low of 51, and there could be showers. And Thursday is also predicted to be showers and thunderstorms with a high of 61 and a low of 41. Friday will be sunshine and patchy clouds with a high of 69 and a low of 48. And Saturday will be about the same, sunshine and patchy clouds with a high of 61 and a low of 41. Today's mini editorial is written by Don Miller from Sioux City, and Don writes, "Hard to believe the unruly puppy kill in South Dakota. Kristi Noem signed into law during her first term a tough penalty of 2 years in prison for animal abusers, 5 years for a second offense, but no penalty for Noem since her family puppy shooting incident was 20 years ago." Again, this was written by Don Miller of Sioux City. We will begin with the coolest things in Iowa. Blue Bunny and Jolly Time among Northwest Iowa products vying for prize. Multiple Northwest Iowa companies and products have a chance to make a little history. The Iowa Association of Business and Industry, or the ABI, and Midwest One Bank are sponsoring the first ever Coolest Thing Made in Iowa competition, and some familiar names made the list of 68 nominees from across the state. American Popcorn Company in Sioux City, Century Farms Distillery in Spencer, Dobson Pipe Organ Builders LTD in Lake City, GOMACO Trolley in Ida Grove, Merrill Manufacturing in Storm Lake, and Wells Enterprises in Lamar's all made the cut. As did Young Guitart LLC, which is based in Minnesota, but makes the Shoe Oot product in Hawarden. The products with the most votes will advance to the top 16. Individuals may vote once per day, per device, through April 30th, according to the Coolest Thing Made in Iowa website. Manufacturers employ nearly 225,000 Iowans and produce incredible products that are distributed locally, nationally, and globally, ABI President Mike Walston said in a release. This is another opportunity to showcase their work and draw attention to what happens right here in our backyard. The winner will be announced at ABI's annual Taking Care of Business Conference, which is being held in the Quad Cities from June 4th through June 6th. It was easy for us to decide to participate in the 2024 Coolest Thing Made in Iowa contest, Wells Enterprises Director of External Communications Leslie Bartholomew said. Ice cream is definitely a cool product, and Blue Bunny is well known and loved by Iowans across the state. We were excited to nominate our Blue Bunny Mini Swirls since they are a Wells invention that not only is a favorite in Iowa, but is a bestseller nationwide. Wells Enterprises, the second largest ice cream maker in the United States, was acquired by Italian confectioner Ferrero, maker of Nutella, in 2022 after more than a century of family ownership. Wells still maintains its headquarters in Lamar's, as well as a sizable manufacturing operation in the Plymouth County seat. Tracy Bover, the senior director of marketing for the American Popcorn Company, best known for its Jolly Time brand, so the Sioux City staple felt privileged to be recognized not just for its legacy, but for its unwavering commitment and meticulous quality of our employees. Every popcorn product produced is a symbol of their dedication, ensuring that families everywhere can savor the joy and excellence we bring to their home, Boover said. Gary Smith and cousin Carlton, who remain on the American Popcorn Board of Directors, stepped away from the company's day-to-day operations earlier this year. The Smiths are great-grandsons of Cloyd H. Smith, who founded the American Popcorn Company in 1914. Steve Huizinga, who has spent nearly his entire career and more than half his life to this point with the American Popcorn Company, is now at the helm as president. One of the first trolley projects from GOMECO was for Loyal Lowell, Massachusetts, from 1982 through 1984. And a division of the Gomeco Corporation started by Harold Godberson in 1965, the manufacturer of authentic vintage trolley cars has done work across the state, throughout the country, and around the world. In 2016, Gomeco's Taroko Park project had its grand opening in Taiwan. We are definitely used to people being blown away by the unique work we do, so we think being coolest in Iowa would be a natural fit, and we hope the voters will help us to get to the next round, Gomeco Trolley Company manager Lex Jacobson said. Begun in a one-car garage in Des Moines 75 years ago by Noel Merrill Anderson, Merrill Manufacturing of Storm Lake submitted its Any Flow Frostproof Yard Hydrant for the contest. It is amazing to see the variety of products in the contest. Our state is full of innovation, Angie Jones, Director of Marketing, said. We are excited to see the outcome, and our team has been having fun rallying for votes on social media. At least one of the Northwest Iowa products to make the cut can be imbibed. Century Farms Distillery of Spencer has its single-barrel straight bourbon on the list. We think this is a perfect fit for the Coolest Thing in Iowa contest because, at our core, that's who we are, said Century Farms Marketing and Sales Manager Katie Cardell. We work with family farms to make their bourbon and then label every bottle we sell with a QR code that tells the unique story of that family and their farm. We now move to a school board story. Gausman attorney seeks $53,000 in fees. Sioux City School Board member Dan Greenwell faces having to pay over $53,000 in attorney fees that former Superintendent Paul Gausman incurred in his civil suit, three other board members, and the school district. In ruling earlier this month, Woodbury County District Court Judge Jeffrey Neary found Greenwell did not act in good faith in his role in closing a January 24, 2022 school board meeting. Neary had ruled earlier the session violated open meetings law because it went beyond the board's state purpose of evaluating Gausman's professional competency. As part of his most recent ruling, Neary ordered Greenwell to pay Gausman's attorney fees as well as the court costs and a $500 court fee. Neary has scheduled a May 30th hearing to determine the attorney fees owed. In advance of that hearing, Gausman's attorney, Stanley Munger of Sioux City, on Monday submitted an affidavit for $53,438.58 in fees to date. His spreadsheet includes fees dating back to February 2, 2022, with hourly rates of $350 for himself and $175 for his paralegal. Munger said additional fees will be submitted after the hearings in the case concluded. Greenwell's attorney will have until May 20th to respond to Munger's affidavit. Gausman, who left the Sioux City District to become the superintendent of the Lincoln, Nebraska Public Schools on July 1, 2022, filed a lawsuit in January 2023 against board members Greenwell, Jan George, Taylor Goodvin, and Bob Michelson, claiming that they held two separate closed sessions that cited the wrong section of state code in order to avoid notifying him of their discussion and their plans to file a complaint against him with the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners. Neary found George, Goodvin, and Michelson acted in good faith in their roles in holding the January 2022 meeting. In an earlier ruling, the judge found the board properly closed a November 30, 2022 meeting cited by Gausman. While a member of a governmental body violates the state open meetings law, each member shall pay damages of no more than $500 and no less than $100 for the violation, according to state law. Members are not required to pay if they voted against the closed session, had good reason to believe they were in compliance of Iowa Chapter 21, the state's open meetings law, or relied on a formal opinion in writing as to why it was allowed. If the damages are assessed, the member must also pay all costs and reasonable attorney fees in the trial. The court concludes that defendant Dan Greenwell did not have a good reason to believe, and in good faith believe facts, which, if true, would have indicated compliance with Chapter 21. He was clouded by how he felt toward Dr. Gosman and thus did not act in good faith, but rather with vindictive purpose, according to Neary's ruling. And now we move to a story about the Gordon Drive Viaduct. Representatives of the Iowa Department of Transportation told Sioux City Council members, city department heads, and project stakeholders Monday they will be submitting multiple grant applications to help fund the Gordon Drive Viaduct replacement, which has an estimated total cost of $193 million. The intent is to get as much federal funding for this project to lessen the burden to the state of Iowa and the Sioux City taxpayer, said Jessica Felix, Iowa DOT District 3 engineer. She said that during an informal meeting held at the Elves Downtown Library. We will be putting in multiple grant applications. The 3,970-foot-long viaduct, built in 1937 and improved in 1963 and 1966, will be replaced with a 98-foot-wide viaduct. At the same time the viaduct is reconstructed, contractors will replace two arms of the Bacon Creek Conduit, a portion of which was built in 1909, that run beneath Correctionville Road and Gordon Drive. The cost of the viaduct replacement is estimated at $157.5 million and the conduit at $35.6 million. The Iowa DOT has taken the lead in designing the entire project. The city will pay for the conduit replacement, utility relocation, and other costs. Construction will not begin until 2028. The DOT prefers to go off alignment to the south for the reconstruction of the viaduct, according to preliminary plans, which are subject to change. Felix said this will allow the DOT to maintain traffic in each direction for as long as feasible. Felix stressed the DOT is still doing information gathering. She said a public hearing for the project will be held in October, followed by a 30-day comment period. After the comment period, she said a solidified preferred alternative will be in place. As of last Thursday, we have 926 utility conflicts, and that does not include the utility conflicts with the city. So one of the unique things we have going on is a pilot for Iowa DOT right now on getting out ahead, she said. I will say that some of the utility conflicts might drive peer location, especially on the west side, and that will be with Mid-American. And there is a large natural gas pipeline that serves Nebraska. Felix said the DOT is waiting for a finalized report on a Phase 2 environmental archaeological study conducted on the east end, as well as on a property in the former stockyards area. Right now, what you see up there is the draft preferred alternative, Felix said, referring to a preliminary plan which was projected on a screen. Copies of the plan were also handed out to meeting attendees. A reminder, it is a series of trade-offs, and so we're not voting. It's not a democracy where if everyone agrees, that's what we're doing. We try to build consensus, but ultimately, as department and along with Federal Highway Administration, we have to do that series of trade-offs with the environmental process to balance landowner impact, safety, traffic operations, birds, bees, water. Felix described the viaduct replacement project as an igniter project, which could spin off other projects for other agencies. The DOT would not be in charge of those projects. Sioux City Economic Development Director Marty Daugherty said the project is a great opportunity to have something aesthetically really significant that changes the look of the whole area for a really long time. He also thinks the connection to Cunningham Drive is going to be tremendous for continuing redevelopment of the old Stockyards area. Councilwoman Julie Shaner said she's already in talks for projects in the old Stockyards area. I love it, she said of the replacement project. I see the development and redevelopment down at the old Stocks area. I do not see anything as far as that would be a negative for the community. I see that just as you said, an igniter. Felix said the new structure will be up to 8 feet taller at points, which means it will be visible from the interstate. She said the DOT is currently looking at hand railing, but she said the city could pursue aesthetic lighting for the viaduct. She said the DOT intends to demolish the existing viaduct once the new structure is in place. We will be hopefully leaving all the timber piles in place. We'll cut them down about 2 feet below grade, she said. Paul Knievel of Omaha-based design and engineering company HDR walked attendees through the project's preliminary plans. He said building off to the south will allow four lanes of traffic to be carried on the existing viaduct during the first phases. Knievel said there will be some times during construction when traffic will have to be reduced to a single lane in each direction on Gordon Drive. Floyd Boulevard is going to remain as a grade-separated intersection. There will not be an intersection there. That was something that was discussed early in the project. From a traffic standpoint, it just doesn't work. Things really break down badly there, so that is not a feature of the project, he said. Since the Anderson Spur will be maintained, Knievel said the viaduct's profile needs to stay high to provide railroad clearance. While the profile over the railroads will be a little higher, he said it will be lower at Cunningham Drive. There is a set of railroad criteria that we have to meet on every project. We don't have a choice about it. Basically, they will not permit the project if we don't meet it. We have to maintain 23.5 feet of clearance over the railroad tracks. That's why the profiles do get a little bit higher in places here than what they are existing, said Knievel, who noted Steuben Street will be maintained as a through street as it is today. And then we exit off the bridge and we're into basically more pavement. The reason for this pavement area here is we want to facilitate a very important feature with this project. Something we've heard from local stakeholders is that the Cunningham Drive connection is important. Felix said the posted speed limit on the new viaduct will be 35 miles per hour. With the current speed limit of 45, she said, the viaduct acts like a speedway. By putting in traffic signals at Cunningham Drive and at Lewis Boulevard, it's going to give that traffic calming effect and kind of allow that corridor continuity along Gordon Drive. So you will not have this raceway anymore between downtown and the neighborhood, she said. Knievel said Bacon Creek is a major drainage way on the project. He said the 1909 channel has gotten to a point where it's not feasible to repair it and it needs to be replaced. As it is reconstructed, Knievel said the capacity of Bacon Creek is going to be increased. The other issue with Bacon Creek is that hydraulic analysis would indicate that it's undersized, though there hasn't been any significant flooding down there for a number of years. Just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it will not. Man pleads not guilty of robbing Sioux City Bank. A man has pleaded not guilty in federal court of robbing a downtown Sioux City Bank. Jonathan Birdnecklas, 31, of Sioux City, on Friday, waived his personal appearance for arraignment and entered his not guilty plea in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to one count of bank robbery. Birdnecklas is accused of entering Great Southern Bank, 321 Pier Street, on January 23rd and handing the teller a check that had a note on it saying, "Push the alarm and I will shoot you. Pretend to cash, $15,000, no games. I will know and I will shoot you." According to court documents, the teller gave the robber $2,405 and he left the business. Court documents do not say if the suspect possessed or displayed a weapon during the robbery. A fingerprint taken from the robbery note was identified as Birdnecklas's. Downtown surveillance cameras also show a man identified as Birdnecklas changing his clothing in an alley near the bank before and after the robbery. Birdnecklas was arrested later in the day at his brother's home with approximately $1,900 in his possession. He was initially charged in Woodbury County District Court, but the case was dismissed after he was charged in federal court. Birdnecklas had been released from prison less than 2 weeks before the robbery after completing his sentence for robbing the same bank in 2014. Onawa woman charged with burglary in Sioux City. An Onawa, Iowa woman was arrested Saturday on suspicion of forcing her way into a Sioux City apartment and slashing a resident's arm with a knife. In a complaint filed in Woodbury County District Court, Desiree Buckman is accused of walking up to the front porch of an apartment in the 1300 block of the Court Street at about 8:38 p.m. Saturday and asking one of the residents for money. When the resident attempted to go inside the residence, Buckman, armed with a knife and a long metal stick, pushed her way inside. Another resident came to the door to help get Buckman out of the apartment and was cut on his left forearm when Buckman swung the knife at him. Buckman, 37, was arrested and booked into Woodbury County Jail on one count of first-degree burglary, a Class B felony. Her bond was set at $25,000. Sioux City man found guilty of kidnapping. A federal jury has found a Sioux City man guilty of holding a former girlfriend against her will and firing a gun at her. After a five-day trial in U.S. District Court in Sioux City, the jury on Friday reached its verdict, finding Bobby Roden, 49, guilty of kidnapping and possession of ammunition by a felon and drug user. He faces a possible maximum sentence of life in prison. A sentencing date has not been set. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, a trial evidence showed Roden used threats to get the woman into his car on July 28, 2022, to help him recover a phone she had taken. Roden brutalized her and drove her to at least two locations to find his phone during a 36-hour period. The woman eventually escaped by running to a neighbor's house. As she was running, Roden fired his gun at or near her. Roden previously was convicted of forgery and drug distribution in a Scott County, Iowa, and a drug charge in federal court. We now move to the weekly Tuesday five questions with, and today it's with Sarah Cragthorpe, owner of Jitters, about moving the coffee shop to a new home. Jitters, the downtown Sioux City coffee shop, is on the move again. This week, Jitters is in the process of relocating from its spot at 306 Virginia Street to the Floyd River Flats, a newly renovated apartment building, formerly the Ramada Inn, at 130 Nebraska Street. The coffee shop, noted for its donuts, has moved several times in its 25 years in business. For a time, it was a sort of a chain with locations all around town. Briefly, I had three. We were in Leeds and then also on Pearl Street, and then we had the kiosk out at Western Iowa Tech, said proprietor Sarah Cragthorpe. Jitters has been at the Virginia Street location for a decade. For a week or so at the end of April and beginning of May, there will be no Jitters in town with the closure of the Virginia Street location. The Floyd River Flats shop is expected to open its doors the week of May 7th. Their space at Floyd River Flats, about 2,830 square feet, is roughly 600 square feet larger than their Virginia Street location. The Journal spoke with Cragthorpe about the move for its five question series. First, why is Jitters moving? Hirschbach, our next door neighbor, owns a building and my lease is up the 30th of April, and they want to take over the space. Will the menu change at all with your move to the new space? Initially not. We'll start out with what we have. We do soups, salads, desserts. We have a full menu of food as well, which is what we started with back in 1999, and then we added the donuts in 2009. Is your donut making equipment coming with you to the shop? That's a simple answer. Yes. Will you miss anything about your former space? We love this space, and we've kind of outgrown it. If you've been here on a weekend, when we have a line to the door and every table is full and there's no parking, it gets to be a little chaotic. So we're very much looking forward to a larger space with better parking. And then how many donuts does your shop make in a day? We average during the week probably 100 to 125 dozen donuts. And on the weekends, we can easily do 150 to 175 dozen. South Sioux City man dies in shooting. A Sioux City man was jailed following a fatal shooting early Saturday morning in South Sioux City. At around 4:23 a.m. Saturday, South Sioux City police and EMS were dispatched to the Flatwater Crossing Apartments at 2800 Flatwater Drive for a reported shooting, according to a press release from the South Sioux City Police Department. On arrival, the officers found a 24-year-old man dead of apparent gunshot wound to the chest. A preliminary investigation found that the victim, who has not been identified, was shot by another man while the latter was handling a firearm and unintentionally shot the victim. Alcohol is believed to have played the role in the incident, according to the press release. Tobias Guy Thomas, 23, of Sioux City, was arrested and charged with manslaughter and held in the Dakota County Jail. Investigation is ongoing. Storm Lake man pleads not guilty of robbery. A Storm Lake man has pleaded not guilty of attempting to rob another man at gunpoint. Netapan Ludwig, 37, entered his written plea Friday in Buena Vista County District Court to one count of first-degree robbery, a Class B felony. According to court documents, Ludwig approached a man in the 200 block of East 5th on March 2nd, displayed a handgun and demanded money, then fled into a nearby apartment building after learning the man was not carrying any cash. On March 5th, the Storm Lake Police Department's entry team and Buena Vista County Sheriff's cert team executed a search warrant at an apartment at 220 East 5th Street and located Ludwig. During a search of the apartment, police located a BB gun pistol in Ludwig's bedroom, matching the description of the gun displayed in the robbery. Governors oppose National Guard move to Space Force. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen, and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem signed onto a letter Monday alongside 45 other state governors, as well as five territories and commonwealths, opposing the Biden administration's move to incorporate Air National Guard service members into the Space Force. The letter from the National Governors Association, addressed to Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, is written in opposition to a legislative proposal submitted by the Department of Defense to the Senate Armed Services Committee that would transfer some Air National Guard personnel and equipment currently being used on space missions to the Space Force. The Defense Department proposal would require Congress to override existing law requiring that governors approve changes to National Guard units through Title 10 and 32 of the U.S. Code that outlines gubernatorial authority over their state's National Guard. The bipartisan group of governors signing the letter said the proposed measure would hurt governors' abilities to use the National Guard in response to crises. Governors must retain full authority over these units to protect operational readiness in America's communities, the letter states. Legislation that sidesteps, eliminates, or otherwise reduces governors' authority within their states and territories undermines long-standing partnerships, precedents, military readiness, and operational efficiency, the letter states. This action also negatively affects the important relationships between governors and the DOD at a time when we need to have full trust and confidence between the two to meet the growing threats posed by the era of strategic competition as well as natural disasters. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall told federal lawmakers earlier in April that the proposal would shift roughly 700 National Guard members to Space Force as part of a one-time transfer. Art Deco architectural heritage to be celebrated in Sioux City. When most people see the Rose Garden behind the Grandview Park Bandshell, well, they see a bunch of roses. But when Tom Munson sees Grandview's Park Rose Garden, the Sioux City Public Museum Archives Manager connects it to the history of the community. He said the Rose Garden and the Bandshell were both Civilian Works Administration and later Work Progress Administration projects that were designed to put people to work during the Great Depression in the 1930s. Each represented the Art Deco style of architecture that were popular at the time. Known for its bold use of geometric shapes, exotic zigzags, and Middle Eastern-inspired motifs, Art Deco brought a sense of drama to a nation reeling from the stock market crash of 1929. Using sleek lines that were influenced by airplanes and ocean liner design, it brought energy, modernity, and most importantly, optimism during a time when it was desperately needed. As a way to celebrate this form of architecture, the Sioux City Historic Preservation Commission will dedicate May 6th through May 11th as Elegance in Line Celebrating Art Deco with a week's worth of fun and informative events. The week will start with Mayor Bob Scott and the City Council officially announcing the kickoff of Sioux City Historic Preservation Week during its May 6th meeting. At 6 p.m. May 7th, Munson will give a walking tour of the Heights neighborhood that surrounds Grandview. While Art Deco was most common in the architecture of buildings and commercial styles, it was a style that was rarely used in the construction of private homes, Munson said, noting that most of the houses in the Heights featured a prairie school style of architecture. While there are two houses that can be considered Art Deco in design, the majority of the homes in the Heights are definitely prairie-inspired. Very common in the Midwest in the late 19th and early 20th century, prairie school style homes can be identified through its use of horizontal lines, hipped roofs with overhanging eaves, as well as horizontal lines that were designed to evoke the native prairie landscape. Munson said, while earlier and later styles of design borrowed from classic European architect, the prairie style was organic to America. This wasn't the case with the Badgerow Building, which will be awarded the Sioux City Historic Preservation Commission's annual Treasure of Sioux City Award, with a ceremony slated to take place at 4 p.m. May 10th on the 622 4th Street Building's 12th floor. Designed by the Sioux City architecture firm of K.E. Westerland, the Badgerow was completed in 1933. More than 90 years after it was constructed, the building is now home to the Badgerow Flats, which are apartments that combine the Art Deco of the 20th century with the modern conveniences of the 21st century. Indeed, the Badgerow still retains the elements of Art Deco with its use of vertical piers, bronze ornamentation, and windows which are highlighted with geometric designs. Don't be surprised if the Badgerow Building is an answer to a question posed during the Pints and Preservation Trivia competition hosted by Munson that is being held at 6 p.m. May 8th at Buffalo Alice. Sioux City Historic Preservation Week will end with the second annual Sioux City Historic Bike Tour that will pass by local historic sites, starting at Chautauqua Park at 10 a.m. May 11th and finishing at Riverside Park. In addition, the Sioux City Railroad Museum at 3400 Sioux River Road will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. May 11th, giving people a chance to see its historical exhibits with free admission. The highlights of the week for Munson will be the tour of the Heights, which is a neighborhood he grew up in. You can tell a lot about a community through its houses, he said. The Heights definitely show the progression of Sioux City over time. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now go to today's obituaries. Judith Ann Lecce, 79, of rural Marcus, passed away on Saturday, April 27th at a Sioux Falls hospital with her family at her side. Funeral services will take place at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, May 1st at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Remsen. Reverend Alan Cummins will officiate. Burial will follow at the Marcus Amherst Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th at the Ernest Johnson Funeral Home in Marcus. The family will be present from 5 to 7 p.m. There will also be 1 hour of visitation at the church prior to the service on Wednesday. Judith Ann Lecce was born on August 27, 1944, in Cherokee, Iowa, to Marion and Ella Mae Miller. She spent most of her childhood on the family farm near Remsen and graduated from Remsen Union High School in 1962. On September 12, 1964, she married the love of her life, Philip Lecce, in St. Paul Lutheran Church in Remsen. Phil and Judy were looking forward to celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary later this year. The couple were blessed with two sons, Kirk and Eric, who they raised on the family farm south of Marcus. After high school, Judy attended MBT Business School in Sioux City. Shortly thereafter, she started a long banking career, nearly all of which she spent at Farmer State Bank in Marcus prior to her retirement in 2013. Judy's top priority was always as wife, mother, and grandmother. She loved attending the events of her children and grandchildren, spending countless hours watching all kinds of athletic, academic, and musical performances. She enjoyed playing cards, traveling, keeping a spotless house, and doing anything that involved spending time with her family and friends. Judy was a lifelong member of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Remsen, volunteering her time for several church activities. Jacqueline Jackie Tay Ryg, and that's spelled R-Y-G-H, 94, of Sioux City, passed away April 27th. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. May 1st with a visitation 1 hour prior at 10 a.m. at St. James Global Methodist Church. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Jackie was born on April 19, 1930, in Sioux City to Worth and Pauline Walter Meyer. She graduated from Central High School in 1948. In 1950, she was united in marriage to John H. Rye. He preceded her in death in 2007. Jackie worked as a receptionist at IPS, which is now Mid-American Energy. She was proud to be a contributor and tail wagger fundraiser for the Little Yellow Dog, which her father had started in 1936. She was also a volunteer with the Shriners and would accompany families to the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis. Jackie was a longtime member of St. James Global Methodist Church. Her faith was very important to her. She enjoyed cooking, baking, dancing, and spending time with her grandkids. For the past several years, she enjoyed the companionship of Fred Wells, traveling and spending time together. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Little Yellow Dog at littleyellowdog.org or transportation services at Sioux City Shriners International. Rose M. Hagen, 98, of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, April 25th. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 1st, at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Tuesday evening at the funeral home. Dolores May Visser, daughter of Joseph and Carrie Huck, was born on September 2, 1929, in rural Melvin, Iowa. She passed away peacefully on April 23rd in Sioux City. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 4th, at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel in Sioux City. Burial will follow at East Lawn Cemetery in Sheldon. Visitation will be Friday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Dolores' journey through life was marked with love, dedication, and a deep sense of family values. Dolores grew up in the area of her birth until her junior year when the family moved to Sheldon. After graduating from Sheldon High School, she started working as a waitress, where she met her beloved husband, Dirk Visser. And their marriage on May 2, 1949, was the foundation of a beautiful family with three children. Dolores and Dick lived in Sheldon until 1974, when they moved to Sioux City for Dick's job. Dolores's commitment to her loved ones extended beyond the home as she worked at JCPenney department store both in Sheldon and later in Sioux City until her retirement. A compassionate and nurturing individual, Dolores prioritized family above all else. She found joy in hosting family dinners and creating lasting memories with those she held dear. In her leisure time, Dolores enjoyed gardening, knitting, needlepoint, and many other crafts. She cherished moments spent at their cabin at the lakes. In honoring Dolores' memory, let us celebrate a life well lived, a life dedicated to family bonds and cherished moments that will forever live on in the hearts of those who knew and loved her. Jean Bertram, 81, of Ireton, passed away on Saturday, April 27th, at Hillcrest Healthcare Services in Hawarden. Funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, May 2nd, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Ireton, with Reverend Michael Boothby officiating. Burial will follow at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Ireton. Visitation with the family will begin at 5 p.m. Wednesday, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. The Porter Funeral Home in Ireton is assisting the family. The family prefers memorials to be directed to Orange City Area Hospice or to St. Paul's Lutheran Church Memorial Fund. Shirley Jean Meyer, 89, of Bancroft, died on Thursday, April 25th at Mercy One Medical Center in Sioux City. The funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, April 29th at Mundelow Smith Funeral Home in Bancroft. The visitation will be 1 hour prior to the funeral on Monday at Mundelow Smith Funeral Home. Burial will be in the Bancroft Cemetery in Bancroft. Memorials are suggested to the Bancroft Senior Center. Arrangements are under the direction of Mundelow Smith Funeral Home in Bancroft. Shirley was born on December 29, 1934, in Sioux City to Charles and Elsie Oler King. She attended and graduated from Leeds High School in Sioux City in 1953. On April 18, 1954, Shirley married Glenn Meyer at Calvary Lutheran Church in Leeds. Shortly after, the couple moved to Ogden, Utah, where Glenn served in the U.S. Air Force. She was baptized into the Church of Christ in Ogden in 1954. After Glenn received an honorable discharge, the couple moved back to Bancroft, where Shirley spent most of her time helping Glenn on the family farm and raising their family. Shirley was a 4-H leader for 25 years, an active member of the Bancroft Senior Center, serving as an officer on the board, a member of the Jolly Neighbors, and in the Extension Club in Bancroft. She taught Sunday school at the Church of Christ. Shirley enjoyed playing cards, canning vegetables, fishing, and camping. Later in life, Shirley and Glenn liked taking trips to Texas and would spend the winters there. Shirley was a caring individual and belonged to the caregiver group so she could help others. Shirley loved her family and especially her grandchildren. Irvin John Ehlers, 91, passed away on April 25th. Massive Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 30th, at Holy Name Catholic Church in Marcus. Burial will be at St. Mary Cemetery in Remsen. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday. Rosary and prayer service will be at 5 p.m. at the Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen. Services have been entrusted to the Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen. Barry Williams McDougall, 74, Sioux Falls, formerly of Lamar's, passed away on Sunday, April 28th. Funeral services will take place at 11 a.m. on Friday, May 3rd, at the Methodist Church of Lamar's. Burial will follow at Memorial Cemetery in Lamar's. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, at the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's. The family will be present from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. There will also be 1-hour visitation at the church prior to the funeral service. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll now move to a story from Wayne, Nebraska, about the annual John G. Neihardt Spring Conference and the opening of the time capsule. Throughout the 43rd annual John G. Neihardt Spring Conference, celebrating Nebraska's first poet laureate, the ideal of the illumination of life came up repeatedly. During the boring stretch of the event, a presenter showed a clip of the Wayne State alum referring to literature as just such an illuminator. The greatest illumination came at the end of the event, though. Coralie Hughes, the granddaughter of Neihardt, who wrote The Black Elk Speaks and The Cycle of the West, stepped to the podium in the Ramsey Theater on the Wayne State College campus and revealed to a crowd of several dozen people what was found in a time capsule Neihardt put inside of a monument a little more than a century ago. A copy of Wayne's Goldenrod newspaper from July 30, 1923, the day before the capsule was placed, as well as a manuscript pages of Neihardt's The Song of Hugh Glass, which he had torn into sections and placed in the box. We were not surprised that the contents were all paper. We were surprised that they were all wet, Hughes said. Multiple floods did sweep across the land over the years. There wasn't total certainty what all would be in the box, and Hughes said she had hopes for a personal note of Neihardt's. No such luck. John G. Neihardt, born in Sharpsburg, Illinois in 1881, moved to Wayne in 1891 with his mother and two sisters. One of his early jobs was ringing bells at Wayne State when it was still called Nebraska Normal College. Neihardt graduated from the school at 15 with a teaching degree. After time in the classroom, he moved to Bancroft, Nebraska in 1900 and began to write more professionally, first for the Omaha Daily News and later for himself. He became a published author at 19, married at 27, started his major work, The Cycle of the West, at 31, and became Nebraska's Poet Laureate at 40, according to the John G. Neihardt State Historic Site, which is located in Bancroft. Hughes, who was 21 when her grandfather died, said his bibliography is a blessing and a sort of beguiling thing. It's magical to me. It's kind of like there's two people that I'm connected to, she said. One is my grandfather, who I would do anything for, including opening a monument, and the other is this individual that is so beyond my ability and my creativity that you don't feel related in the same way. A collection of epic poems, The Cycle of the West, includes The Song of Hugh Glass, the frontiersman who survived a horrifying grizzly bear attack in what is now Perkins County, South Dakota. The story was later captured in the 2015 film The Revenant, which actor Leonardo DiCaprio, who played Glass, won an Academy Award for. The 2024 conference focused on the 1923 construction of a monument recognizing Glass, built in part by Neihardt, and how the 1.5-ton concrete marker made its way from near Lemon, South Dakota, to Bancroft. Neihardt family members recovered the memorial piece, which contained a time capsule, in October of 2023, and opened it, but waited to disclose the contents until the conference on Saturday, which Hugh said was the first time it had been held at Neihardt's alma mater. Hugh said a lot of experimenting had to be done with concrete to figure out how to best open the monument without permanently destroying it. To look inside without tools, a CT scan of the structure was considered, but no one with such an instrument was interested enough to make the trip. Chisels and brushes were eventually employed, as was a metal detector. She said the preservation of the monument was always really important to us, and we did succeed in that. Not everything was taken out, and Hugh said the monument was not refilled, so tourists to the Bancroft site can see the box the items were carefully removed from. The materials await further analysis and then will be displayed at the center where Marianne Reynolds is the executive director. After the event ended, she said she felt a rush of energy. At the end of the conferences, you're usually exhausted and you just want to collapse. I want to go back to the Neihardt Center and start thinking about that monument and what we can do to get people to see it, she said. Timothy G. Anderson, who wrote a biography of Neihardt entitled Lonesome Dreamer, said he understood the Nebraska Neihardt Club had initially planned to build 5 monoliths. Every time he wrote a new book-length poem, they would build a monument, Anderson recounted. They never got the other ones done. Anderson, who met Neihardt in 1972, said he has attended at least 20 conferences dedicated to the writer. The programming for 2024 included lectures on Neihardt, as well as Glass, Nebraska's hidden historic monuments, and more. This one is nice because here there's some Wayne State students. Otherwise, a lot of times when you go to these conferences, the average age is 66, and you think, this is pretty fun, but is it going to be fun 10 years from now? Is there going to be anybody here? So it's a challenge to keep younger people interested, Anderson said. At the time of its construction, Neihardt challenged students to revisit the monument in 2023, open the time capsule, recite portions of the Song of Hugh Glass, and celebrate as mountain men might have, the Nebraska Examiner reported in a preview for the event. To keep the tradition going into the future, former Wayne State College professor Joseph Waxelman, who spoke at the conference, reportedly deposited an entirely new time capsule at the Grand River Museum, which is in Lemon. The plan is for it to be opened in the year 2123. When the reopening happens, it will be a vindication of a phrase student presenters used while offering a poetic ode to Neihardt. His legacy lives, his legacy lives. We'll now move to a sports story, Muskies drop opener versus Fargo. The Sioux City Musketeers head into Game 2 of the USHL Western Conference Finals Monday night, looking to even the best-of-5 series with the Fargo Force. The Musketeers dropped Game 1 by a 3-1 score in Fargo Sunday night. Sioux City took a 1-0 lead in the first quarter on a goal by Owen Keefe at the 7:59 mark. Ethan Gardula and Brian Nicholas assisted on what turned out to be the Muskies' only goal of the game. Less than 3 minutes later, the top-seeded Force tied the game on a goal by Max Swanson. Fargo took the lead, a wild play at the 12:57 mark of the second period. Michael Estarza, Sioux City goalie Sam Urban, attempted to redirect the puck behind the net, but Fargo's Harpet Bence collided with Urban's stick. The puck traveled over the net to Starza, who hit it in midair into the net. The Force added an insurance goal in the third period as Michael Estarza scored at 1:12. Fargo goalie Hampton Skluniski who gave up the fewest goals per game over the course of the regular season, turned away 21 of 22 Sioux City shots. Urban stopped 32 of 35 shots in the loss. Sioux City head coach Jason Kirschner told the rinklive.com his team struggled to make the most of his offensive opportunities. "It's an execution thing," Kirschner said. "When we have opportunities to make plays, we need to make them when we're there. We left too many plays on the table tonight." The Musketeers were playing for the first time in 6 days after sweeping the Lincoln Stars in the conference semifinals on Monday, April 22nd. In 9 meetings against Sioux City this season, Fargo has won all but one. The Force won the Western Conference regular season with a 53-10-1-0 record, while Sioux City finished second at 37-22-5-0. Game 2 of the conference finals series was played Monday night at Shields Arena in Fargo. Results were too late for the Journal's deadline for Tuesday's paper. Sioux City will host Game 3 at the Tyson Events Center on Thursday, as well as Game 4 if necessary. If the series goes the distance, Game 5 will be in Fargo on Sunday, May 5th. The winner advances to the best-of-five championship series for the Clark Cup, which the Musketeers captured 2 seasons ago. We'll now move to Dear Abby and our first letter. "Dear Abby, my husband rarely says thank you and almost never apologizes for anything. The other day, I was at an office party to which family members were not invited. I brought home a plate of food for my husband, for which he refused to thank me when I hinted that a thanks might be nice, especially since it was dinner time. The office lunch had been hours ago, and I had brought nothing for myself. He said because I had not come home when I said I would, he didn't feel the need to thank me. When I told him it's common courtesy to thank people, he continued arguing and eventually threw the plate of food across the room. Now he won't apologize for that either. He feels he was justified in throwing the food. Abby, my husband is a college professor and well-educated, yet he often overlooks common courtesy. He usually walks fast and ahead of me when we're going places. He never says, 'You look nice,' and he leaves the house without mentioning where he is going. It doesn't concern him that it upsets me, as he is convinced that he is right about everything. The food throwing is an extreme example of his behavior, but it has me concerned about his mental health at this point. Advice, please. Signed, Never Thanked in New Jersey." And the reply: "Your husband's mental health is fine. What you have described in detail is not new behavior. The professor has been an educated boor for years and is clearly unwilling to change. I would question your judgment for having tolerated his disrespectful behavior for the length of time you have, because he has shown you repeatedly that your feelings are of little consequence to him. Dear Abby, my sister lost her husband a year ago. She has 3 grown children, but she has a fractured relationship with her 30-year-old daughter. I am heartbroken because I have 2 daughters, and I can't imagine what my sister is going through. My niece was close to her father and has thrown in my sister's face that he was her person, and she told him everything. My niece and I have a good relationship, and she confides to me things she does not speak to her mother about. I am debating whether to speak to my niece to get a sense of what her issue with my sister really is. My niece blames her mother for everything. I'm not sure if trying to help will backfire. Please help. Involved aunt in Connecticut." And Abby's response: "I am sure you mean well, but I don't think it would be helpful to insert yourself as a mediator between your sister and your niece. For whatever reason, your niece felt comfortable confiding in her late father more than in your sister. Stating that fact out loud was not throwing it in someone's face. Your relationship with your daughters is clearly different from the one your sister has with hers. Unless you want to alienate your niece, let the two of them work it out." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, April 30th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.